The following is a recording of the Thomas Paine Unitarian Universalist Fellowship. We are located in Collegeville, Pennsylvania. We are also located on the web at www.tpuuf.org. Please come visit us.
Writer Peter Mayer likens himself to a bowl mended to the Japanese art of kintsugi. The word kintsugi literally means golden joinery or golden seams. And the video recording of his song provided images of ceramics with broken pieces, lacquered and bound together with thick seams of glue, dusted with precious metal, gold, platinum, or silver. You may have noticed that in some examples, the bonded pieces weren't even part of the original piece. Kintsugi is an extension of wabi-sabi, a Japanese philosophy that embraces the modest, the incomplete, the imperfect, the impermanent, and the beauty that comes with age and use. In that context, what makes kintsugi so meaningful is that it doesn't just make flaws visible. It highlights them. In a way, it celebrates them. It demonstrates that in the process of repairing or restoring something, we can create something more unique, more resilient, more beautiful, even more valuable. As such, kintsugi could be a defining analogy for life itself, couldn't it? A process of finding meaning and value in imperfection, in impermanence, in shortcomings, and engaging determination and skill to restore, to recover, to make whole again what constantly breaks and breaks down, not just in our property and possessions, but also our bodies, our spirits, and our relationships with others. Good morning, everyone. I'm Jerry Lazzaro. I chair the worship committee here at the Thomas Paine Unitarian Universalist Fellowship. Our fellowship is a principle-based, truth-seeking, justice-seeking, welcoming faith community. And on behalf of the committee and the fellowship as a whole, I want you to know that whoever you are, wherever you may be on your spiritual journey, on your life journey, whatever you must in conscience, truly and responsibly believe, however you identify and express your gender, whomever you love, whoever loves you, we welcome you and invite you to worship with us this morning and every Sunday morning. And this morning, I'm honored to be part of a special service here at Thomas Paine. However far we can stretch the metaphorical limits of kintsugi, it certainly applies to the act of writing, downloading onto a page the full range of our experiences is a way to recover good times and good feelings that might otherwise fade from memory. It also is an opportunity to fashion a coherent image out of the often disjointed fragments of our lives, to make whole again what may be broken, to find a silver lining in a disappointment, to find value in what may seem to others to be of little use or worth, and to derive meaning and even beauty in pain, in sorrow, even in trauma. James Pennebaker, a psychologist at the University of Texas at Austin, studies how writing about emotional upheavals in our lives can improve our physical and mental health. One of the brain's functions, Pennebaker explains, is to help us understand events in our lives. Writing helps construct a narrative to contextualize trauma and organize ideas. I think it's kind of a way of putting pieces together or putting them back together, you know? Members of our TPUF writers group would agree wholeheartedly, I think, with these assessments of the impact writing has on their lives. Our service this morning is a shared pulpit service in which members of our writers group will share an example of their work. And in keeping with the November Soul Matters theme, our service is writing as a pathway to repair. And the title is intentionally ambiguous. In one sense, it refers to the healing and restorative power of writing. And it also takes, it recognizes that writing, the writing process itself, involves repair. That is, it takes conscious effort to find or create a path for expression of ideas and then to mend and amend those ideas through proofreading and editing. Participating in our writers group may seem to some like just an add-on to our mission as a fellowship, but I believe it's an integral part of that mission. Our seven principles resonate in the work of our TPUF writers and in the discussion their writing generates, from affirming personal worth and dignity to affirming acceptance and spiritual growth, from affirming a free and responsible search for truth and meaning to affirming the interdependent web of existence of which we're all a part. In short, in the work of our writers group, I hear expression of the human spirit that transcends orthodox belief to reach the essence of spiritual practice. As I see it, our TPUF writers would agree, I think, that a practice is spiritual when it reveals our personal desire to establish a felt relationship with the deepest meanings or powers governing life. And the deeper, more universal spirituality is alive and well in our group and in this community, I believe. It's certainly alive and well in the TPUF Writers Group, as I think you'll agree when you hear samples of the work shared at the service this morning. But first, as we do every Sunday, and at other times when we meet as a faith community, we will light our chalice. The chalice and the flame together form the symbol of our free faith. They signify, among many things, our openness to the wisdom of many ages, traditions and cultures, and our aspiration to keep the light of truth, the warmth of compassion, and the fire of commitment to freedom and justice burning within ourselves and throughout our world. Let's light the chalice with these words. May this chalice stand for bowls with jagged veins of gold, and may this flame that flickers remind us of the impermanence, imperfection, and fragility of all we know or know of. May they speak to us of the continual need for restoring, for mending, for healing. And may this flaming chalice inspire us to be menders and healers and to embrace the wisdom of the great Sufi poet Rumi. The wound is the place where the light enters you. And I think we've already lit our peace lamp this morning. Okay. As we do each time we gather for worship, and we offer a brief prayer that in the face of all the conflict and violence that we witness around us, we still maintain hope for peace within ourselves and throughout our world. May peace be with us. And now our gathering song this morning, it's hymn 324, Come Sing a Song with Me. Selected this song because I think it speaks to the healing that takes place in a supportive community where we reach out to others to share their experiences and share their stories. And I think we have a little thing. This is, you all know this, right? It's come sing a song with me. Come, it's, so, you know, we can do this. turning the lectern over to members of our TPUF writers group who share a work they've created. Our first writer is Karen McCann. I've asked Karen and all our readers. Oh, we don't, well, I don't see, oh, we, oh. You guys snuck in at the last minute. Go now in peace. Go now in peace. May the spirit of love surround you everywhere, everywhere you may go. And I now have the pleasure of turning the lectern over to members of our TPUF writers group. First up is Karen McCann. And I've asked Karen and all our readers this morning to introduce themselves as writers, as well as to introduce the piece they're going to share with us. So, Karen?
Thank you, Jerry. I'm Karen McCann, and the reason why I write is to express myself and basically get it out of me. If I can put it on paper, then it just makes me feel that I have accomplished something and have gotten it out, whether it's pleasant or not so pleasant. I think it's good to express it and get it out there somehow. This is called Repair of the Heart and Soul. I feel like I've been repairing all of my life, and maybe that's what everyone does. I think it's called growth. Here are a few repair moments of my life. I left college after 3 years feeling totally defeated. I had changed my majors each year and ended up with a professor who told me I should be working at Litt Brothers, not going to college. I made an appointment with the dean and I made a formal complaint against this professor. The dean smiled, said he was sympathetic to my feelings, and then told me the professor was his brother-in-law, and there was nothing he could do. I thanked him, got up and left. I went back to my dorm, packed up my stuff, and went home. Time for some repair. I did so by going out to California and staying with my brother and his wife for the summer. Then I returned home and got a job. I left this job after a couple of years, after being told I could not be promoted into another job because I was a female. They wanted a male in that position. Now remember, this was 1968. I was already doing part of that job along with my regular job. I left that manager's office. I did not thank him, and I went back to my desk, cleaned out my stuff, and drove home. I apologized first to the two wonderful men that I worked for there, and they both told me that they understood, and this was not fair, but it was completely out of their hands. Time for more repair. I repaired by crying over lunch with my mother about the injustice of it all. And she said she had just noticed an ad in the paper for a new company in Hatfield that was hiring. It was a steel corporation. I went up there right after lunch and applied for a job. I was hired on the spot, and it was a lot more money, $74.40 a week. I got married while working there, and after 8 years, I filed for divorce. It was difficult in those days to divorce someone. There wasn't any no-fault divorce process. I had to state the real reasons I wanted a divorce, and it was embarrassing to me. My ex-husband then was so angry with me that he advised me to move out of his territory, the Lansdale area, so I did. I moved to East Norriton and started over. I found out months after renting my condo that an undercover drug agent had been murdered there. I ignored that and continued to repair my heart by attaining one of my life's goals, and that was to start a family. I worked for the Steel Corporation for 23 years, advancing to top management. Imagine a girl who should have been working at Lip Brothers getting to this position. This division was eventually bought out, and I was given my walking papers. This was really a hard one to swallow. I'd gotten married again, and we had 4 children between us. When I lost this job, the kids were at ages that required subtle but firm monitoring. They were all early teenagers. So I started my repair by taking a night job at a meat processing plant. My job was second shift weighmaster at the rendering plant. I transferred the truck weights from the truck scale to the computer as the filled trucks came into the plant, also recording the contents. A lot of these trucks carried restaurant grease. Many carried carcasses from various places. All of it smelled really bad. I used to think, I know, Lip Brothers smells better than this. I worked 4 to 12, went home, showered and slept, started again at 6 a.m. to help the kids get off to school. Then I worked around the house till it was time to go to the other job again. If I was lucky, I got in a short nap. But this crazy schedule balanced with my husband's daytime job for 5 years, so it all worked. Until it didn't. Time for more repair. After 18 years married, this husband decided he wanted to be single again, so another divorce was in order. Neither of us wanted our large house, so we each moved to smaller homes. My oldest daughter moved with me. I repaired by crying a lot to my friends and taking on a second job, a part-time one, to pay off debts incurred during the marriage, for which I was partially responsible. After 18 months at the call center, for which I could write an entire book, I was again solvent and resolved to stay this way forever. It took me a long time to repair from this betrayal. Repairs are not always quick and easy. They sometimes take years. I had left the rendering plant job after 5 years for a proofreading job at Merck. My oldest daughter, who lived with me, was a huge help when my aunt in Alexandria, Virginia, fell to a brain tumor. My aunt was 102, lived in a beautiful facility, walked daily, and swam laps in the pool every morning at 102. This daughter, who I was second mom to, drove us down there weekend after weekend after weekend until we had the 3-bedroom apartment cleaned out. My aunt only lasted a few weeks once diagnosed, and she never regained consciousness. I was responsible for getting this apartment cleared within a tight timeline so the facility could rent it to the next party. We both worked hard. Sometimes my youngest daughter came down to help. It was quite the task. My aunt had traveled the world, and much of her apartment was filled with things purchased in many different countries. I didn't even know what I was dealing with. I really got to know this oldest daughter, though, as I had never known before. We had hours and hours to talk and work and drive together. I think we discussed every topic possible. We got to know each other in a new way. I was her second mom, and our relationship grew. And this was a repair of sorts of my heart, and it helped me through my aunt's passing. My aunt was a Unitarian. I knew nothing about Unitarians, except from my mother's viewpoint, which was anything but positive. My aunt's minister met with us about the memorial service, and both my daughter and I were quite impressed. A few years later, this daughter and her family started attending TPUF and did so until they moved out of the area. She highly recommended it to me, so I began attending. I wasn't sure I wanted to join, so I attended 2 years plus until I finally did join. I'm not a joiner by nature. But I was impressed from the start and continue to love coming here. It's a place of safe haven for me. It's comfortable and educational. This was a repair for both my heart and my soul. Repair to me means settle with the results of the issue and move on. Repair time should give you a different outlook than you had. It should let you see another side of yourself, and it should allow you to give yourself some grace. The situation will never return to what it was. Find something to use as repair and move on. We are not perfect. That would be so boring. And now we will present Butch Larcenies. Thank you.
Mike, do we have that photo? Okay. I call myself, I don't do, let's say, autobiography, just this is what happened. I do memoir, which is certain moments of my life. And then, and there are generally ordinary moments. The last two stories I wrote, well, one was about what size spoon I should eat my soup with, and another one is about the proper use of an office stapler. But today, today was about repair, and I do have a repair story. I wrote this sort of like in the Joseph Campbell says, find a myth in your life, and you'll get it. Okay, I call this battling the Hydra. The following was the myth I lived during my preteen years. First, Hercules lured the coily creature from the safety of its den by shooting flaming arrows at it. Once the Hydra emerged, Hercules seized it. The monster was not so easily overcome, though, for it wound one of its coils around Hercules' foot and made it impossible for the hero to escape. When I was in my early teens, my parents argued with each other. They wouldn't talk to me. My father would walk out on us, and both were abusive. Every day I felt like I was walking on eggs. Anything I said could be misunderstood, misconstrued. Anything I did could be wrong in either of their eyes. I did feel like I had one of the coils of the Hydra tightly wrapped my torso, tying my arms in place, and another around my legs, preventing me any forward movement. I was always in a state of tension. I was afraid. With his club, Hercules attacked the many heads of the Hydra, but as soon as he smashed one head, two would burst forth in its place. To make matters worse, the Hydra had a friend of its own. A huge crab began biting the trapped foot of Hercules. To cope with living in an atmosphere like this, my mind turned to performing obsessive-compulsive rituals. I used this as a form of control, or so I thought. It was magical thinking. With every smash of a club for Hercules, there was a counting of every turn on a doorknob, or the stepping on every other tile for me. Of course, this was temporary. For every head he smashed, two grew back. For every compulsive ritual I performed, the need to do it again arose. I then realized you can't fight fire with fire. You can't fight ego with more ego. Quickly disposing of this nuisance, most likely with a swift bash of his club, Hercules called on his nephew Iolaus to help him out of this tricky situation. Each time Hercules bashed one of the Hydra's heads, Iolaus held a torch to the headless tendons of the neck. The flames prevented the growth of replacement heads. And finally, Hercules had the better of the beast. Once he had removed and destroyed the eight mortal heads, Hercules chopped off the ninth immortal head. This he buried at the side of the road leading from Lerna to Elaeus, and for good measure, he covered it with a heavy rock. Cauterizing stops the blood flow and prevents infection. It is a method of healing wounds. I did something healing. I let the intervention of my ego go. After that, I promised myself that I will never give in to performing compulsive rituals again. Although I didn't feel a sense of awe at the time, I do now as I reflect on this as the dragon I defeated. Sometimes I can find a quote from someone that adds something to this, and I found one from an American novelist, James Allen. He says, "As the physically weak man can make himself strong by careful and patient training, so the man of weak thoughts can make them strong by exercising himself in right thinking." And this is a picture of a statue of Hercules fighting the Hydra, and that is a statue I own. I keep it in my office to remind me of my victory. And now on to Jerry.
Hi, you know me. I've been writing ever since I was a teenager, and I gravitated toward poetry early. That was sort of my love. It was my first affection, I guess, with the literature. And my early writing, I would call sort of an objective writer. I really didn't write about myself. I really avoided consciously the I in a poem. But as the years went on and things happened, I found that I needed to call up that I, to reach deep into myself, to deal with some things that happened. As most of you know, one of the things that happened was my 18-year-old, vibrant, joyful, beautiful daughter was killed in an automobile accident. And over the years, I've had opportunities to write about that experience or to try to come to grips with it. And one time in our writer's group, we don't do this often, but sometimes we'll make the writer's session a workshop. And we'll come in and say, oh, here's a prompt, here's an idea. Okay, everybody write about it for 15 minutes or something like that, and then let's share what we've come up with. And one time, this is when Deb Murata was leading the group, she suggested a prompt, "I knew I was healing." And I started to write this, and then over time, in fact, the last time I edited this poem was last month. I knew I was healing. When I recognized thirst, when food acquired taste again, when I no longer waited hours in darkness before troubling to turn on a light, when I no longer dreaded waking from a few hours of deep sleep, no longer dreaded crawling into bed, I knew I was healing when gravity slowly stopped slowing my step, as if I walked with iron weights shackling my ankles, when my chest stopped needing to lift a boulder whenever I spoke of her, when words others spoke seemed articulated in a native tongue, when I could listen again to Casals play Bach's suites for unaccompanied cello, when I dared pick up the guitar to play a Christmas carol, when every holiday seemed other than another funeral, when I no longer struggled to muffle the voice urging me to just keep driving until the car ran out of gas, then walk from wherever it stopped, keep on walking until I could no longer stand, crawl until I could crawl no further, then lie down wherever that might be, somewhere, anywhere, I could no longer feel cold or hunger or pain or hope, or loss, or love. When I stopped having to wait in the car for the courage to enter a house empty now of her voice and music, when I could write words such as these and recite them and wonder or care what, if anything, they might mean. I have the pleasure now of introducing a writer, of songs, our own Christine Winchester Perry. And When I told her about the theme here, she has a song, and it's called Broken. And actually, we shared this some of this experience together, right? Okay, and so I'm going to turn this over to Christine now.
And then I'll cue you when I'm done. Anyway. Okay. As a songwriter, I'm keenly aware of the power of self-expression to help me cope with and process the events that happen to me and that I come in contact with. I have an old song that I've done here before called Just Another Song in My Book, which explains the process of chronicling the events in my life by writing about them. Maybe some of you remember hearing me do that here. I also have a fairly new song, which I hope to perform here in a few months, called Tell Your Story, which encourages the listener to write it down, sing a song, gotta tell your story. But today, I'm gonna do a song called Broken, because I felt it would fit well with today's theme. This is a story song about a man I met last year through my work in real estate. So it's not my story, it's his, written from his point of view. Unfortunately, it doesn't provide any happy ending or solution to his sorry state, but perhaps it's the song that he would have written to process his challenges if he were to write a song about it. What I can tell you is that I was deeply saddened and affected by this traumatic situation that I was involved with quite intensely and for many months. And writing this song helped me to process it. Okay, Mike, thanks.
Body failed me, brought to life.
is Flo Shore.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Okay, so a little bit about me. I write memoir and poetry. And since 2009, I've been part of a writer's group that mainly writes memoir called the Women's Writing Circle. And we have self-published a couple of anthologies. And I'm going to read a short story from one of the anthologies. And the way we work is we heal and repair ourselves by sharing our stories and our unique voices. And this particular story harkens back to childhood and for me kind of recaptures a time of innocence and wonder, which is very easy to lose or lose track of or let go of as we get older and our experiences from childhood are replaced by experiences from adulthood. So this story is called Butterfly. It was late spring of 1964 and the end of a bitter winter. Summer was not far off. I could hardly wait for school to be out. Summer was synonymous with freedom, to roam the woods, go barefoot when mom wasn't looking, and daydream in the shade of the big weeping willow tree in our backyard. I enjoyed playing with the other children on my street. We played dodgeball, kickball, or climbed construction equipment that belonged to one of the neighbors who lived at the end of the street. We liked nothing more than to hop up into the well-worn black seats of the tractors, backhoes, and enormous front-end loaders and survey our universe of rust-colored dirt. Johnny, a self-appointed foreman, barked orders. There was work to be done. Although I had fun, I sometimes preferred being all alone and would sneak away to read a book or sketch. I was a very shy and pensive child, a dreamer with an unmistakably creative Piscean nature that lent itself to reflection. One night that spring, I decided not to play with the other children. It was a warm evening. I stood in the driveway with my dog, Fuzzy. We were watching the setting sun through the forsythia bushes, which gave them a golden glow. As I watched the sunlight slant across the forsythia, I saw a monarch butterfly flutter around the side of the house and across the gravel driveway. I stood still. Its vibrant orange and black color caught my eye. For once, I wasn't thinking about my unfinished math homework that left me stumped, or the seemingly endless array of chores my mother glibly dispensed, or even the cliquish girls at school. The butterfly, this marvel of nature, came to light on my upper arm. Riveted, I instinctively knew not to move or even breathe for fear that it would startle and fly off. It felt like several minutes had elapsed as it rested there, though in fact it had been mere seconds. Although the butterflies resting on my arm seemed like a miracle to me, I did not mention it the next day at school. I didn't really trust anyone to understand and was certain they would laugh at me. A scornful, "So what?" or "Who cares?" would be the likely response from my fourth grade classmates. That evening, however, I needed to find the magic again. My plan was to stand in just the same spot at around the same time and see what might happen. I stood still and silent in the driveway. Excuse me. Again, the butterfly flitted by me. Would it remember me and alight? I held my breath and waited. To my amazement, the butterfly rested on my outstretched arm. I examined its delicate, fragile feelers, fine and brown. Was it examining me as well? Perhaps it recognized me by my short pixie haircut, fair skin, and hazel eyes. On the third night, I waited again in the driveway at the same time in the evening for what seemed an eternity. The sun was beginning to set, and I was afraid that I might soon hear my mother's lilting voice calling me in for the night. I felt a strange tickle as something touched my left ear. My involuntary response was to brush whatever it was away quickly. I felt sick to my stomach and my heart sank. Had I wounded my dear friend in haste? I looked down, and to my relief, I had only brushed away a leaf that had drifted down from one of the tall maple trees. Grateful to have caused no harm, I continued my vigil. Sure enough, my companion returned. The monarch paused tentatively for just a moment on my arm. At that moment, I felt deeply attuned to nature. I had often wondered, what would it be like to converse with all the animals, birds, and even insects? What incredible stories they might tell. Now, I seem to have been given the opportunity to know this one beautiful creature and to appreciate how fleeting its life was destined to be. By the fourth night, it had become a comforting ritual to step out onto the gravel driveway and wait for a sign. The stillness was once again a welcome change from schoolwork, chores, and even kickball or climbing on the construction equipment. The sun sparkled and the forsythia looked like pure gold. This time, however, I wasn't so lucky. This time, there was no butterfly. Although disappointed, I wasn't at all surprised. Everyone knows butterflies don't last forever. For a few days, I felt special to have gained the trust of so magical a creature. The evening shadows widened as I went inside. The screen door banged behind me. I left my dreamy world of insect friends and the wonders of nature somewhere out there. I consciously decided to commit to memory the events of the previous three nights. It surely was not my imagination, and I would not allow anyone to tell me otherwise. I keep hoping to this day that another such friend might take a shine to me. And to this day, I always stop and stand perfectly still whenever butterflies are near. And now, Joanne Walker.
So I'm Joanne, and I've always written, but I started writing a lot during the pandemic because I live alone, and this was my way of having a conversation. So it's going to all hopefully end in a book that I'll give my son, and I've come up with a temporary title called Reflections on My Life. So this is called Life Finds a Way, and I really need to see the page. One of my favorite movies is the original Jurassic Park. The premise of the story is that human intervention and control is an illusion, as nature or life will find a way to establish balance or restore order over human restraints. At one point early in the movie, the laboratory supervisor explains to the experts brought to evaluate the attraction that all the dinosaurs are female, so they can't reproduce. Ian Malcolm, perfectly portrayed by Jeff Goldblum, says, "It's not possible. Life will not be contained. Life breaks free. It expands to new territories and crashes through barriers, maybe even dangerously. I'm simply saying that life finds a way." Later in the film, paleontologist Alan Grant, played by Sam Neill, discovers physical evidence of breeding when he comes upon an abandoned velociraptor nest. Realizing that the human inventors had used the DNA of West African frogs, who can change their sex to enable the species to continue, to fill the holes in the dinosaur's DNA, Grant finally sees Malcolm's point, saying Malcolm was right. Life will find a way. This often comes to mind when I'm on a site visit to an old contaminated landfill that I've been involved with for a long, long time. I have seen the 147-acre property go from a massive pile of uncovered trash, furniture, refrigerators, chemical drums, and other detritus of human progress into a growing habitat for an amazing number of plants, animals, fish, and bugs. In the beginning, even when nothing had been done to clean up the site, we found an assortment of bog turtles and a wonderful growth of swamp pink, an endangered plant. After installation of the landfill cap and planting various species of grass, other flowers started to sprout up on the landfill, their seeds having been brought by various birds flying by. Various freshwater fish started appearing in two ponds located to the side of the landfill, where the prior owners had borrowed the sandy soil to cover some of the trash as it came in. At first, I was puzzled by the sudden appearance of fish, but then realized that the fish, too, came from birds flying over who had picked up fish eggs from other ponds and lakes. Then I started to see turtles lounging along the banks of the ponds and on fallen logs. Again, their eggs dropped by birds as they flew over the area. Up until this year, my favorite new residents of the site were a few blue herons and an awesome albino deer. The herons would come and go, but always returned to the site. I often felt that its quietness and solitude were what kept them coming back. Other than me and a few other humans who worked at the site, there are no disturbances from human beings at all. Most of the sounds now are of insects and frogs chirping, birds cooing, and the rustle of the wind through the high grass and sprouting forested area around the edge. I think they mostly feel safe here. Well, except for the deer. She was majestic even as a fawn, a light coat of almost transparent fur, a very pale white nose, and the pinkest eyes I have ever seen. She lasted through one winter, but after the second fall, deer hunting season, she was gone. I fear she is now a trophy on some hunter's mantle. But the herons are multiplying and the other new birds are arriving all the time. Last week, when I was at the site, I took a long walk around the landfill and into the barrow areas, which are now developing wetlands. It was a bright blue, relatively warm day. The site staff told me earlier this year that they had seen a pair of bald eagles. I hadn't seen them yet and feared they had flown off somewhere. As I hiked around the wetlands looking for animals and birds, the air was perfectly still and all was quiet. And then I saw them. High up in a tree, two bald eagles. They just sat there staring at me. I wish that I had brought them a gift, maybe a live mouse or two. Instead, I stood there empty-handed and perfectly still. They watched me for a few moments. None of us were moving. And then they took off, their large black wings, once airborne, taking advantage of the air currents to rise almost effortlessly to great heights. The majestic pair dominated the sky with their white heads glistening in the sunlight as they glided between the few billowy clouds in the brilliant blue sky. They were glorious as they soared above in the quiet stillness around us. Oh, how I wished I could fly with them, ascending and gracefully flying away, their heads carefully perusing the area below them. They headed back toward me, but flew right over my head to a higher, unreachable tree. Slowly, I turned and headed back. I was grateful for this moment of peace and awe that the eagles had granted me. I turned back for one last look, and they were gone. Looking up, I saw them flying off over the pond, likely in search of dinner. And as I walked away, I thought to myself, yes, life does find a way.
We've experienced some stunning sharing of thoughts, of experience, of life. Some of us may not be quite as articulate as these writers, but writing does that for one. It develops the power to share, to draw the meat out of an experience, set it down, save it so you can savor it and share it. But those of us on the care team hope that many of you have highlights from your life to share, low moments of your life to share. Matters of the heart is a time when we get to know one another better, as we have certainly learned to appreciate more of these of our members. So if you can share a highlight, which may be your response to this service, or some sorrow you now experience, please come up, tell us who you are, and share. And when those of you who are here have shared, there will be an opportunity to those for those online also to share by raising their hand. Tech will explain how that happens. But please come, tell us what's on your mind and in your heart.
Before we bring this time of sharing to a close, Tony would like to share a few more words. We will sing Spirit of Life, but not just yet.
This is a work by Richard S. Gilbert called Gentleness in Living. Be gentle with one another. It is a cry from the lives of people battered by thoughtless words and brutal deeds. It comes from the lips of those who speak them and the lives of those who do them. Who of us can look inside another and know what is there of hope and hurt, or promise and pain? Who can know from what far places each has come, or to what far places each may wish to go? Our lives are like fragile eggs. They crack, and the substance escapes. Handle with care. Handle with exceedingly tender care. For there are human beings within, human beings as vulnerable as we are, who feel as we feel, who hurt as we hurt. Life is too transient to be cruel with one another. It is too short for thoughtlessness, too brief for hurting. Life is long enough for caring. It is lasting enough for sharing, precious enough for love. Be gentle with one another. And now, let us sing Spirit of Life.
Save my heart.
As I think this morning's service confirmed, our TPUF writers are talented and thoughtful people who can educate, entertain, and even inspire, right? What you haven't experienced this morning, though, is the sharing that occurs when we discuss the works presented at our meetings. We're committed to providing a collegial, supportive environment in which to explore the challenges and rewards of written expression. So critiquing work is not the focus, really, although constructive feedback is always available upon request, right? More often than not, we discuss the themes and messages in the work and how it relates to our own experiences as writers and as members of the human family. We meet at the Fellowship, 10:30 a.m., once a month on either the last or next to last Sunday. The Zoom option is available for those who can't attend in person. And if you're interested in becoming involved with this affinity group here at TPUF, watch for announcements in the newsletter and order of service, or just let me know you're interested and I can add your name to the Writers Group email list. Our closing song this morning is Comfort Me, which I think is about appropriate right now, okay? The comfort we seek may often be in writing that would call something from ourselves, and often that comfort comes from sharing what we uncover in the process with others. And of course, we find comfort in the understanding, support, and encouragement of those around us. As the words of the song repeat, sing with me, comfort me. resolve to continue the work of repairing what needs to be mended, restored, recovered within ourselves, our relationships, and our world. May our words, spoken or written, heal and not harm, help and not hinder, bless rather than curse. May our own wounds inspire us to be more compassionate toward others. May our own limitations encourage us to be kinder when dealing with the limitations of others. Let us take this flame of compassion and kindness with us into the world to share with those whose lives we touch and whose lives touch our own. Please stay with us for announcements and for the postlude.